Gene Shepard has been called a cross between Mark Twain and H.L. Mencken. Adam Gopnik called him a Beat Generation Garrison Keillor. His most commercial success was as writer and narrator of the holiday classic A Christmas Story, but to his legions of radio fans, he is the legendary father of freeform talk radio. For 21 years, his nightly monologues on WOR-AM were broadcast across the Eastern Seaboard, and Eugene B. Bergman has written the first ever biography of him called Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard. It's published by Applause Theater and Cinema Books, and I'm very pleased that it's brought Mr. Bergman to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
It's been 28 years since Gene Shepard broadcast his last radio show, but aren't there a number of websites dedicated to him and eBay stocks Gene Shepard items?
Yes, there are three websites. The main one is called flicklives.com, and it has a tremendous amount of material on all aspects of Shepard's life and work, and in fact, it even has some archived audios you can listen to directly.
So do you think that is the result of his still having so many loyal fans all these years after, or is he gaining new fans?
Well, I do think it's a combination. He's never lost his core fans. In fact, there were tens of thousands of them. His program reached 28 states in the East, and he had, as I say, maybe 60,000, 100,000 fans, and many of them are in the media because he influenced people to go into the media. So there are people all over the place who are still rabid Gene Shepard fans.
And what do you think the appeal was?
Well, for me and for so many people, he had this ability to talk to you as though you were the only one. It was as though you and he were carrying on a dialogue. He was a great conversationalist, except that he was the only one doing the talking.
He only had four live guests in all those years.
As far as we know.
John Cassavetes, and it's rumored that he helped finance Cassavetes' first independent film, Shadows.
Well, yes. In fact, Cassavetes was on, and instead of talking about his movie, The Edge of the City, he said, gee, people should give me a little money and I'll make a better movie than that. So Shepard fans actually sent about $2,000 in, and Cassavetes was able to rent equipment, buy film, and in fact, one of the opening credits says, presented by Gene Shepard's Night People.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's quite a statement for the biggest American independent film.
Well, of course, it's also in the spirit of Gene Shepard's message that we go against all of the powers that be. There was something of a rebellion built into all of it. Do you think that was part of it? I mean, or was it the fact that he felt that trivia was not trivial?
Well, there was certainly an aspect of rebellion. So many kids, especially high school, college students, would listen to him with the radio under the pillow so the parents couldn't hear that they were up that late.
I thought I was the only one.
So many people did think they were the only one.
My parents had no idea until I put the radio out the window one time when he said, put your radio out the window, and he screamed something about how all the neighbors were idiots. And my parents said, what are you doing?
That was hurling an invective, as he used to call it. But, you know, his fans were not just kids. Some of the kids who listened to him grew up to be Andy Kaufman, the comedian, Billy Collins, the U.S. Poet Laureate, etc. But he had fans among the creative forces in America of his time. Jack Kerouac was a fan.
Norman Mailer, I gather.
Well, Norman Mailer and he both worked at the Village Voice. According to Shepard, he used to have conversations with Mailer. According to Mailer, he only vaguely remembers them, which to me is a big put-down on purpose.
Jill Pfeiffer also worked at The Voice.
Yes, and Pfeiffer was a good friend of Mailer's. In fact, I interviewed Pfeiffer and got some nice comments.
Now, he also wrote for Playboy, and I gather Hugh Hefner was a fan. Was he actually listening? Because Hugh Hefner was living in Chicago, and Gene Shepard, who comes from the Chicago area, and had started in Chicago, made his big name here in New York, didn't he?
Right. Well, the thing about that, I managed to interview Hugh Hefner, who told me that his remembrance is that Shel Silverstein, who was a good friend of Shepard's and a good friend of Hugh Hefner, recommended Shepard as someone who would be a good one to write for Playboy. And according to Hefner, it was Shel Silverstein who got Gene to write that, to talk into a microphone and record his stories, and then get them on paper, edit them, and submit them to Playboy. And Playboy published 23 of his short stories.
Mm. So, and that's pretty much what he was doing on the radio, wasn't he, telling a short story?
Well, he did tell a lot of short stories, but he also was very big into general commentary, just letting his mind flow. So you'd get little bits of his commentary about literature, his commentary about the passing scene, and just life in general, and his philosophy in general. So short stories were a part of it, but not all of it.
Well, he kind of started off telling a short story, and then he would stray a little bit and then come back to the story.
Right.
And somehow, by the end of the show, everything had been tied together.
Yes, that's one of the things that so many fans enjoy, that it would seem as though he was rambling. He claimed he didn't ramble, but he would be going off in different directions, like an improviser, but bring it all back together like a jazz composition.
Well, how much of it was written? How much of those digressions were improvised?
Well, virtually everything was improvised. I've talked to numerous people who saw him in action and who talked with him before he went on the air and saw him walk into the studio. He never had anything but a little scrap of paper, a little news item he wanted to talk about. So I think it's pretty well established that he did not ever have a script.
This is around the same time Lenny Bruce was making a name for himself, and he also worked that way. Was there any contact between the two of them?
Yes, they knew each other. And in fact, at the memorial service downtown after Bruce died, Shepard was one of the people who spoke.
And Shepard, as you said, was influenced by jazz. I mean, seriously influenced by jazz. He knew a lot of jazz musicians and appeared on a jazz record, a famous record by Charles Mingus called The Clown.
Yes, and he was also the MC for several very important jazz concerts in New York in the 50s, concerts with big names such as Billie Holiday and Mingus and several of the other big jazz names. He knew them all, and he also would play jazz sometimes on his program, and his style was so influenced by jazz, the idea of improvisation.
Start off with a theme, then improvise, and then come back, tie everything up at the end.
Right.
So how did all of this happen? He grew up in Indiana in a suburb of Chicago. He told a lot of stories about his boyhood. But I remember listening, and it was a long time ago, so maybe I've forgotten things. What I remember more than anything is the details. I have no real sense of what his boyhood was like, other than he seemed to be close to his father, went to a lot of ball games with his father, felt kind of like the weird kid. He told the famous story about going on a blind date and being worried that the girl was not going to be attractive enough, and then realizing that he was the blind date when he saw the look of disappointment on her face.
Right, and in fact, that story is so typical of how he would quite frequently lead you down a certain path, and you were thinking everything was nostalgia and all the good old days, and he would put a little twist on it at the end, and you'd find out that things really weren't so great.
So do you think that was one of his messages?
I definitely think it was. He used to say that he hated nostalgia and that things were not better in the past and they won't be better in the future.
How did he get into radio in the first place?
Well, he claimed that he started as a ham radio operator as a young teenager, And when one of his high school teachers heard about that and they were looking for somebody to broadcast some high school football games, they chose Gene. And then he, from that he went on to some very small radio stations in the Hammond area, and eventually bigger and bigger stations in Cincinnati and Philadelphia before coming to New York.
So when he came to New York, he was coming to the biggest station in the area then, WOR, 50,000 watts, I think the number one station in the country.
And they called themselves the Talk of New York. And, of course, in the morning and in the afternoon, they had the Gamblings, they had Ed and Peggy and Fitzgerald, and quite a number of other people. But for me...
Dorothy and Dick.
For me, the difference between them and Shepard is Shepard really got deeply into things and was more intellectual, while for me, those people chatted.
Well, was he brought in to attract a different demographic to the station? Were they even thinking in those terms in those days?
I really doubt that they were even thinking about it. I think they needed somebody to fill in the late night, and he started... he started with them in some short afternoon programs, but then he got on from 1 in the morning to 5:30 in the morning for about 6 months.
So that's keeping 4.5 hours going.
And again, without any script, virtually no call-ins, virtually no guests. He played a bit more jazz and other music when he was on for 4.5 hours.
Do you think that's one of the appeals? Nonconformists are more likely to listen at night, and here was a guy who was, in a very gentle way, making some anti-bourgeois statements.
Yes, absolutely. He was very much someone who appealed to, say, the more intellectual parts of the high school and college crowd. Someone referred to a lot of his fans as the nerds who would someday grow up and be in broadcasting.
And a review in the New York Times in 1970 called his following a cult of intense proportions.
Yes.
Because people were so intensely in love with what he did. But did WOR ever figure out what his audience was? Because that's the way you attract advertisers.
Well, when you're on late at night, it was pretty hard to get any advertising, and in fact, it was a vicious circle. You couldn't really get advertising late at night, and yet WOR complained that he wasn't commercial. And I heard Larry Josephson earlier in the day talking about the Sweetheart Soap incident, where he said, "Let's all go out and ask for Sweetheart Soap, and just to show that we are commercial." And he did, and WOR cut him off the air because Sweetheart was not a sponsor. And Sweetheart said, "We'll sponsor him," and they got him back on the air again.
He was always trying to show his power doing things like that. At one point, he suggested that everyone, all of his listeners, start asking for a novel called I, Libertine. And too many people did for the publishing world to not notice. Do you think he already had the idea of writing a book in the back of his mind?
It's possible. I'll tell you that from the point at which he first talked about it to the point at which the book was actually out there in hardcover and paperback, it was only a couple of months.
And it sounds like he'd written a book.
Well, eventually the publisher, Ballantyne, got Theodore Sturgeon to quickly churn out a book. And I think Sturgeon wrote it in about 3 weeks.
Under the name Frederick R. Ewing.
Yes.
Patrick's father, I suspect.
My
guest is Eugene B. Bergman. His book, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepard, published by Applause Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break here on WNYC.
Corey. Get your radio on the windowsill and point it outwards, and I'll give you the cue. And when I give you the cue, turn that radio up as loudly as it'll go. We're going to use a very special kind of invective tonight. This is known as the disquieting with a touch of morbid curiosity type, which is quite 23A and a very difficult type to use. You can drop out now if you feel it's a little too strong. It's the morning already. Okay. Radio on windowsill now.
Come home drunk again. What about the kids? What about the kids? I ask you. How long is this going to go on? How long?
Okay, get that radio back in now, fast. This is the Martin Block program. It's time for a make-believe pool room, friends, neighbors. Time to pick up your cues. Time to step over the table and knock off.
We're back with Eugene B. Bergman, B-E-R-G-M-A-N-N. His book, Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, from Applause Books. Was anyone else doing shows as intimate as he was at that time?
Not as intimate. There were other people around who were doing interesting work, such as Henry Morgan, a great wit.
And to some degree, similar in style. Henry Morgan used to make fun of the sponsors, and
yes.
Gene Shepherd, who came along later, also did that.
Mm-hmm. There is the impression, at least in my mind, that Henry Morgan was much more high-strung and possibly scripted, although I'm not really quite sure. But he didn't have the slow-moving, intellectually fascinating engagement that one got from Shepherd.
And Shepherd could talk about anything, voting or children's secret desires to be invisible or his participation in the 1963 Civil Rights March in Washington. This is the sort of thing that later was picked up at WBAI by any number of broadcasters. But I think he may have actually invented freeform radio as much as anybody ever did.
Well, that is the claim, and as far as I know, that's true. And I think anyone on radio now who talks is somehow a descendant of what Gene Shepherd innovated.
Well, he did 4.5 hours. I know he used to do a 5-hour show from midnight to 5. I know that's really difficult to do as a monologue. How long did he keep that up?
That was from the beginning of 56 through about August when he got fired. And then because of the protests and so on, he was brought back on the air. When he came
back,
what
was the reason they gave for firing him?
Well, the one thing was that he gave the Sweetheart Soap commercial when it was not a sponsor. And then another thing he did was that he was told by the general manager at the time that he needed to play more music. In fact, he was fired several times at different radio stations for not playing enough music. And he said, everybody plays music. People want to hear the human voice. So that night, he claims that he did not play one little bit of music, and the general manager fired him again. And again, there was such a protest that they brought him back on the air, and then he was on Sunday nights from 9 to 1.
It was a very long show as well.
Right.
How did he keep it going?
Well, you know,
I mean, you've listened to a lot of the tapes, haven't you?
Yes. I've listened to over 600 broadcasts.
He had to have repeated himself a few times.
Well, he definitely did. And he would recycle material to some extent. But considering that he was on the air for 21 years, there's a tremendous amount of material that was not repeated. And, you know, he even when he was not on the radio, he was talking to people that he knew. Someone who was just introduced to him might get a 45-minute monologue. And then he would go home at night, and he would talk on ham radio. You could not stop him from talking 24 hours a day.
And you warned then that when he said, I'll never forget, it was likely that a total fabrication would follow.
Right, I believe so. I think a lot of the stuff he said may have had inklings of some true incident, but I think a tremendous amount was simply coming out of his imagination.
Was he the same off the air as on the air?
That's what some people who knew him well claimed, that he really was 24 hours the same guy. And one of the things about him being on the air was he was pretty much always a nice guy. But we have found out that sometimes off the air he was not a very nice guy.
Well, he was married how many times?
4 times.
And he had kids with the first wife?
Yeah, actually, most people assume that that was the first wife. Apparently, there was a previous one. So that seems to have been his second wife.
And he had no contact with them.
Well,
he denied that they even existed. That's kind of scary.
He had some contact early on, but then later on, when he would be asked, he would claim that he had no children. And in fact, in his last will, he claimed he had no children. And that's really weird, and it's part of that enigma.
And you, one of the chapters is called The Enigma. But he liked the word enigma, too, didn't he?
Well, he liked all kinds of fascinating words like that.
Excelsior, the title is, he used to shout out Excelsior all the time. Wasn't that the first word he said on most of the shows?
Pretty much, and the idea of Excelsior is it sort of means onward and upward in Latin, which is contrasted with the rest of the phrase, you fathead, which means if you really believe that and act on it too much, you're a dunce.
So irony was the key.
Absolutely.
He is said to have influenced many people. The Jack Nicholson character in The King of Marvin Gardens is based on him?
Well, it's I believe that character is because the character of Jack Nicholson in that movie is a late night talker, referred to as a philosopher, who talked a lot about his own childhood and experiences, and indeed would make some interesting changes in what people thought was just a true story, maybe to be a little bit more artistic or to make a particular point. The Nicholson character did that, and of course Shepard did that all the time.
And then the Jason Robards character in Network.
In A Thousand Clowns.
A Thousand Clowns.
Yes. That character is definitely based on Shepard, and the play and movie were written by Herb Gardner, who was a very good friend of Shepard's. However, the writing of that play ended the friendship between them.
He took it personally?
He took it personally.
You'd think that a guy who made fun of so many other people would have understood that, you know, he was also grist for that mill.
Well, I think he would have liked the character, the nonconformist that Robards plays, all the way up to the end. But in the end, that Robards character has to conform in order to carry on the existence he wanted to. And the final scene in the movie shows him, as I put it, as though he were pinned to the screen like a butterfly, caught in mid-commute with his typical suit on going to the office. And I think that's what Shepard would have hated.
On the other hand, Shepard obviously conformed to a lot of standards. He knew how far he could go, and that's how he lasted 21 years, don't you think?
Yes, well, he liked to, as it said now, push the envelope, but he knew he had to conform in certain ways.
They say that the Johnny Cash hit, A Boy Named Sue, was inspired by Gene Shepard.
Yes, well, Shepard, whose first name is spelled J-E-A-N, was always complaining on the air and off that that people thought he was a woman if they just saw his name. And his very close friend Shel Silverstein picked up on that and just wrote a song about a guy with a girl's name. They were very close friends and they liked to kid each other.
Weren't his musings also the inspiration for the television show The Wonder Years?
Well, that's what Shepard claimed, and it certainly seems that way because in The Wonder Years there was this narrative voice of the adult looking back on his childhood and making comments on it. And that's precisely what Shepard did in his movie A Christmas Story. And in fact, Shepard was thought of as the person who was going to do the narration for the Wonder Years. But something happened. Apparently, he wasn't the nice guy that they expected, and they felt it might be too hard to get along with him. And they didn't give him the job, and he was very bitter about that.
But did he lose other work that way? There was something diva-ish about him. I mean, he was a man, it seems to me, who often thought that integrity really meant being abrasive.
Yes, and he could definitely be abrasive. I'm not familiar with any other particular work that he lost, but he certainly got a lot of work in a lot of different media.
I heard he was embittered in the later years. He lived in Florida, didn't he?
Yes, on Sanibel Island off the Gulf Coast.
Feeling that everybody had stolen what he had created and he wasn't getting enough credit.
Right, and he did not achieve what he had wanted to in radio. And although he achieved some great things, some films and television shows, all of his short stories that were published and other articles, which would have made most people pretty happy, but he wanted more.
He had, didn't he do a lot of things with public television?
Yes, he did several series on public television. He did two series from WGBH in Boston called Gene Shepard's America. There were a total of about 23 half-hour episodes, which were done in an improvisational way. They just developed some new portable television recording equipment, and he and a very small crew would just go out somewhere around the country, and many of the programs he simply winged it, which is pretty fantastic to do on for a television program.
I don't think anybody would allow it today. Was he aware of Garrison Keillor?
He definitely was, and several people I talked with said that, oh, he hated Garrison Keillor because Keillor received so much credit for doing what he did so well, and credit that Shepard felt that he should have received. But ironically, I just came upon a blurb of on the back of Keillor's first book, Happy to Be Here, I believe it's called, and there is Gene Shepard welcoming Garrison Keillor to those who were really funny. Well, in later years, Shepard was not so polite in regards to Garrison Keillor.
I guess if Gene Shepard had a national show the way Garrison Keillor did, he would have had more fans. But that's the problem when you work for a local radio station, even if it is WOR and has the kind of reach OR had.
Well, unfortunately, Shepard was around when the old networks had pretty well fallen apart, and the new networking and satellite radio and other forms had not been established. So he just fell in between those two eras.
He had some ideas that had to have excited the listeners, like Dream Collection Day, where everyone would take the half-finished model airplane out of the basement, the half-finished novel, the cracked guitar, the ancient watercolor, and put it in front of the house. Everyone would have to do it together, all together, cleaning out all those broken, old, I'm quoting him, old, sad, poor, wonderful, idiotic, debilitating, defeating dreams.
Well, he did feel that people sometimes had illusions, say, of grandeur, that, as far as he was concerned, would never or almost never really achieve their goals. And of course, he had illusions of grandeur too, and of course he achieved a tremendous amount, but never as much as he wanted.
Mm-hmm. So, and I think that bitterness probably came across at times, and that may have affected the end of his career.
I believe it did.
Tell us about the Ovaltine decoder ring.
Well, he wrote first he told a short story, and then he wrote it down. And it also became part of his movie, A Christmas Story, where he wanted the little orphan Annie secret decoder that would enable the listener to get the secret message, which was told at the end of each little orphan Annie radio broadcast. And he finally managed to get it. And he gets himself into the bathroom and locks the door and starts to decode. And unfortunately, instead of a really important secret message, it said, be sure to drink your Ovaltine. And the little kid says, oh, a crummy commercial. And, of course, that was just one more disillusioning part of growing up as far as Shepard was concerned. Things were not as nice and ideal as one would like to think they are.
Why did he finally leave OR?
Well, a number of reasons. He was involved in various other projects, such as TV work, his writing, and at the same time, WOR had decided to change its format, and they simply asked a number of very, very long-time major people who talked on WOR to leave, and Shepard was one of them. And he was bitter about that. He would rather have left when and on his own terms, when he wanted. But they sort of forced him into doing it when he wasn't quite ready.
You spoke to 32 people who knew or who claimed to be influenced by him. Did they have varying senses of him?
Well, most of them recognized that he was a genius. Most of them said that he had two very differing aspects. He could be a wonderful, wonderful person doing really nice things. And at the same time, if you caught him in a bad mood, he could be a son of a bitch.
Did somebody like Barry Farber, for example, say that he'd been influenced by him?
Well, Barry Farber came into WOR when Shepard had just been there for a short time, and Shepard became his mentor. And whether or not he was influenced or not, I'm not quite sure, but definitely Farber felt that Shepard was an important part of his early radio life.
He used to talk about meatballs and creeping meatballism. Was he the first person to call someone a meatball?
Well, he certainly gets credit in a dictionary of American slang for the phrase creeping meatballism. So whether he was the first to use meatball or not, he did get credit, and he was really excited on one of his programs. He said, hey, front page of the New York Times book review section. It's a review of a dictionary of slang, and I'm in it. So that was a very, very big thing for him. He always loved to ask people to look things up in a dictionary.
In the appendix of your book is a section called Shepherdism. What are some of the other ones?
Well, Keep Your Knees Loose was a really important ones for him, and most of these, or many of these phrases, have some significance in his philosophy. And
we'll be listening to that one when we go out of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really nice clip. He was very interested in baseball, and he used baseball as a metaphor for life. And he said, you know,
Chicago White Sox,
right,
and all
fan.
Of those losing seasons.
he felt that in order to get along in life, which was ultimately going to be a disaster as far as he felt, you were going to lose eventually, even though you should take great joy in it as it's going along. He said, in order to prevent yourself from having a ball hit at you and hitting you in the knee or you missing it, you had to keep your knees loose. You had to be able to move to respond to whatever came your way. So keep your knees loose was not just some funny phrase. It had to do with the way he approached life.
Hmm. Well, all of us who listened to him and who were influenced by him appreciate this book, and for other people, he will be a major discovery. They'll actually learn how his legacy lives on in people they hear today. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Eugene B. Bergman, also a Gene, but G-E-N-E in this case, talking about J-E-A-N Shepherd, Gene Shepherd, And his book is Excelsior, You Fathead, The Art and Enigma of Gene Shepherd, published by Applause. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Oh, boy. It's Friday night. Yeah? Well, stick in there, friend. Just keep your old knees loose. Just keep your hands ready and supple. Do a little finger exercises once in a while. You want to be able to pick up those fast ground balls, you know, when they hit them down at you. You don't want to muff your only chance. You'll ever get only one in this ball game. You'll ever catch it in teeth. You don't want to do that. Oh, there's no worse feeling than to charge in on a ground ball in front of 42,000 people and have it roll right up your arm and into your ear. I have seen that happen. Terrible feeling, I'll tell you. Especially when you got a 5 3/4 size head. You know, a little pin type thing there sitting on the top of your head. So be of good cheer, friends. And once in a while, when you're in the job, just holler as loudly as you can.